just wanna flat line.
I just wanna
flat line. Maybe this is all my fault,
but I just wanna
flat line.
I just wanna
flat line. Maybe we going to.
Welcome to the fourth installment of the Flatline Fitness Podcast. Joel and Garrett, we are both back to discuss fitness myths today.
Yeah, I'm not going to try to sound that boring, but this is the fourth one. We've been on a little hiatus, had a lot going on.
We've been out and about.
Yeah. Like Joel said, this is going to be some of the top fitness myths that we've come across, heard people say, that we're going to try to set straight today.
No, yeah, and, you know, probably inspiration for this topic was, you know, there's a lot out there on social media, Instagram, Facebook, all these ads having different claims, and all these fitness professionals using, you know, different data to support this or different theories to support this, you know, really what's BS and what's not BS.
Yeah, I just want to let y'all know that Joel made air quotes when he said fitness professionals too, because there are a lot of those out there.
It blows my mind. Like what background do you have to be discussing some of these things? I don't know.
They've been working out for a year and
They got some newbie gains, and they're like, I really know what I'm doing. Yeah. So, you know, and then they start coaching people. Like, there's some people that coach out there, and they really have no idea what they're doing. It blows my mind. Mm-hmm. Like, no. Especially, like, females on contest probes.
Well, no, I saw a guy today on Instagram today that I know that you go to school with. Contest prepping, classic physique competitor. It's like, he posted about it being zero carb, not day. But weak.
Zero carb week?
Zero carb week.
That's really good for training in his muscle tissue.
Joe's being sarcastic. It's not. Yeah.
All right. So as far as fitness myths, you know, we're going to be covering a lot here. It's going to be kind of like spitballing. So as far, you know, Garrett, what do you think is the first thing you'd like to start with?
Okay. No particular order here.
Yeah, no order. We just have a lot of random stuff.
You know, let's talk about one that everybody likes, and that's spot reduction.
Ooh. You have no idea how many times a client comes up to me and is like, oh, you know, I'm kind of, you know, I'm seeing progress or whatever, you know, I'm getting a little bit tired. Man, I just can't seem to lose the belly fat. You know how many times people come, and then they tell me, oh, should I just do different core exercises to drop body fat in my stomach?
Oh, in my midsection, yeah.
Oh, yeah. That's exactly how you do it. My goodness.
Yeah.
What's your opinion on that?
Yeah, so spot training, spot reduction, whatever you want to call it, the idea that you can train a specific area and burn fat in that specific area, it's not a thing. I don't care that there's about the research coming out saying that is a thing. There's been a lot of holes in their studies that I've noticed myself, and a lot of them have already been disproven.
Yep.
It's spot reduction isn't a thing. There's a lot of research claiming that proves that it isn't a thing.
Yeah, the very first study to actually look at it was in 1971, and they were looking at tennis players. You know, they looked at, you know, their
active arms. Yeah, and their arm versus their non-dominant arm.
Yeah, and you know, they were able to see that, you know, the arm that they swung with was bigger, you know, had more muscle tissue. However, there was no reduction in body fat
right
in that arm. So, you know, that was the first strike against body fat spot reduction, especially when you're comparing different arms. Mm-hmm. However, the latest study actually done last year, they put participants through a 12-week training program and actually had them do an upper body training program or a lower body training program. And this is actually the first study to actually look at participants doing different styles of training.
Oh, I think I looked at this study.
Over a long term.
I saw this one too.
And they were able to see that, you know, the upper body people that were training, they actually grew in their upper body and lost more upper body fat than the people that were doing lower body training. And vice versa. Lower body gained more lower body mass and dropped lower body fat, which is kind of, you know, you can extrapolate some information from that and kind of be like, oh, well, you know, they still dropped body fat in those areas. However, in a realistic world, you know, someone who's going to the gym is not going to be only training upper body or only training lower body.
Unless you just want to look unproportional and be made fun of, but that's fine.
the guy with no legs at the gym. I mean, maybe you're training.
We've all seen him.
We've definitely all seen them. So I mean, we can take some data from that study, and you know, there might be a little bit of benefit to spot reduction. Maybe. I would still be hard pressed to say that, you know, it's still a myth in reality, just because in a real world situation, I don't think anyone's going to be going through a 12-week program like
just
that.
Training one, yeah, just training upper, just training lower. Yeah.
Exactly.
So the study I looked at was a 2013 study from the Journal of Strength and Conditioning, where they looked at female athletes undergoing leg press. They just tested leg press and for a 8-week program. And after the 8 weeks, there was no significant body composition change in the trained area. And the reduced fat mass was over in the total, was the total body mass. They tested it by the DEXA, a DEXA scan.
Most accurate. Yeah, it's good that they did DEXA.
Pretty accurate scan. Yeah. So the body fat that they lost wasn't just in their legs. It was pretty much equal throughout their body. This just kind of goes to also disprove the idea that your spot reduction is actually a thing.
So that study makes a lot more sense in my opinion. Mm-hmm. Did they have them doing anything besides leg press? So you mentioned leg press. Is that all they were doing?
They didn't say like you can only do leg press. It was
But was that like the one training?
That was the one thing that they trained. That was the only thing that they trained. That was the one variable today.
And I'd probably say that they were definitely training both lower body and upper body in whatever they were doing. Mm-hmm. So that definitely makes more sense.
Yeah.
And the biggest thing for body, or you know, having different areas of body fat, that's going to be just largely genetic. You know, you can look at Garrett, you can look at me, and you can see that we hold body fat in different areas, and that is just largely dependent upon genetics.
Yeah, it really is. Like, for me, I hold, like a lot of people, I hold my body fat, like, around my waist. I don't hold very much in my legs, and I don't hold very much in my arms.
Which is actually the opposite for a lot of females.
Yeah.
You think
it does, it does vary male to female, so.
Yeah, you've got kind of like, people will allude to the apple body type for males and gynoid body
versus,
type.
Yeah, gynoid versus android. Yeah.
Yeah, and I believe that to a point.
It's a thing.
It's a thing. And it's, you honestly don't know what's going to be reducing as you diet until you go through a long-term diet.
Right. Yeah, so I mean, you're on a show prep right now. You see, you're progressively seeing body fat drop off from different areas, but some of them are taking longer than others.
It's frustrating.
Yeah, no, it is. Like, you're like, you look at, man, my core's looking great today, and you turn around and look at your back, you're like, why am I still holding body fat back there?
I have a lot of lower back body fat.
But it's just a genetic thing. You just have to go through an entire program to get it all off.
So wrapping up that topic, spot reducing, can it happen? I would say no, and studies just show that overall reduction in total body fat mass is going to be how you get rid of that stubborn body fat.
Yeah, it's very minimal.
All right, topic two for discussion. You want to go over exercise stunning growth?
Yeah, no, let's go ahead.
All right, we'll talk about stunning growth. I think I first heard this when I was in middle school, and I was, you know, weight training in off season.
Mm-hmm.
And it was for basketball. It wasn't even for football. Right. I didn't play football in middle school. And I had a couple of uncles that came up to me like, you know, you probably shouldn't be lifting that young. And I was like, you know, my coaches, they had me lifting heavy. And I was like,
right.
I just went with it. You know, a few years down the road, this actually became something I was really interested in as far as researching. Mm-hmm. And they actually first did observational studies of people in Japan. And they looked at adolescents in Japan and looked at workers that worked in the field.
Oh, I saw this study. Yeah, all the field workers. Yeah.
They looked at field workers and saw that, you know, if they had adolescents working in the field, they didn't grow. And when we look at that, we can say that's largely dependent upon race.
I was going to say the race and nutrition. Yeah. So like I didn't look into depth in that study, but my idea was like they probably didn't test for what their nutrition was like.
Yeah, and it was an observational study, so they looked. So they didn't necessarily test for anything.
Okay.
They just looked and said, hey, these Japanese kids aren't growing. Obviously, it's because they're working. And I was like,
when was this study put out. I remember seeing, just glancing at this.
I think it was the 60s or 70s. Okay. I don't even remember the time frame, but it was old. Okay. Very, very old study. And that was kind of like the spark.
Yeah.
If you look at current data, there was a 2014 consensus by over 20 different researchers, and they were able to look that, you know, lifting in the youth, it has almost zero effect on growth during childhood and adolescence.
See, I've seen seen studies go so far to say that it has opposite effects. Like,
yeah, I've seen that too.
They can help increase growth in youth, as long as obviously they're not overdoing it, just because you're gonna put your body in a training deficit then. But yeah, so it's been shown to I forgot where the study was done, in what year. But they showed that it had a possible increase of testosterone levels in youth, which, especially in males, testosterone, growth hormone, if those are increasing, what's that going to do?
You're going to be in a better spot for performance, especially as a young athlete. Mm-hmm. In middle school, you can see kids maturing quicker.
Exactly. Well, if you're increasing those levels by training while they're in those growth periods already, it's just going to enhance growth. I mean, it's going to be minimal, extremely, extremely minimal.
Yep.
But from the data that I looked at, it was there, however minimal it was.
It's even more, I would go as far to say it's even more beneficial for males when they're growing.
I agree.
Because of testosterone production and the effect that muscle tissue has on testosterone.
I agree.
So I would not be scared to have my kid go through weight training at age, you know, like 12 to 15.
Nope, as long as I think their coaches know what they're doing as far as form and everything like that, go for it, yeah.
I think there might be a particular reason to maybe watch out for heavy compounds, such as, you know, I'm not going to put, you know, 315 on a 14-year-old's back, even if he can do it, just because of bone density. Mm-hmm. And that's orthopedics, you know, they told me when I had a herniated disc and bone fracture. They were saying, you know, muscle tissue in adolescence actually matures a lot quicker than bone density does. So if someone's going super, super heavy at a young age, I might tell them to not go quite that heavy. I don't know what your thought is.
Now, what about the idea that them lifting heavy is going to help increase their bone density?
It will.
Because I know for a fact that the DEXA scans I've done, my bone density has changed year to year because of my training increases. I forgot what the actual measurements were on the DEXA, but it went from being, you know, moderately to upper level density to, within a year, maxing out the scales on how dense my bone was, especially around the joints, due to those weight bearing exercises.
I think one thing what we can take away from that is that it's variable, and things like calcium in kids.
Yeah.
You know, drink your milk. Yeah. If your kid's an athlete,
that's not a myth.
Yeah. Have them drink their milk.
That's not a myth.
I wasn't a huge fan of milk when I was a kid.
Heck, if you're not a kid, if you're an adult, you need to be consuming calcium.
My personal opinion is I probably wouldn't have my kid in maybe the 2 to 5 rep range or whatever, but I would definitely, you know, have him pushing himself in the weight room. That's just my opinion. I think Garrett and I might have a different opinion on that.
No, that's good. This is good training.
Okay. Anything else that you want to touch on as far as stunning growth?
I like it.
Put your kids in the weight room. That's my opinion.
It's not a bad thing.
I'll let you take the next one.
All right. Let's talk a little bit about stretching prior to competition or exercise. The idea that it's going to help improve performance. Yeah. So there's the study that I looked at. Sorry, my phone's going off over here. Let me mute that.
Come on.
Yeah.
We're on the podcast here. I need you to prepare for this.
So there's a study that I looked at from the 2009 Journal of Strength and Conditioning again. They've got a lot of good stuff in there. I look at that just because being a certified strength and conditioning specialist, I get those journals sent to me.
That's going to be the most notable spot to look at, as far as, in my opinion, when you're looking for it.
So those are always good places to look. So they looked at the acute effect of ballistic and static stretching on exercise bouts, looking at your flexibility and the maximal strength of the athletes they were testing.
Are they considering ballistic and dynamic the same thing?
No, those are two different things, yeah. Ballistic is going to be like going down, touching toes, and bouncing.
Okay, yeah, okay.
Yeah, ballistic, that's dynamic would be, you know.
Ballistic as in pulsing and dynamic as in movement over and over.
Yeah, movement over and over as it pertains to your sport kind of thing. Yeah. So they didn't test dynamic, just ballistic and static.
Okay.
Static stretching being, you know, lean down, touch your toes, and holding, you know, quad stretch, hold, that kind of thing.
Just long stretching of muscle tissue.
Doing this before exercise. So their study in the show, they did a one rep max on a leg press. Overall, flexibility was improved among individuals. However, their one rep max decreased significantly after static and ballistic stretching. They saw around a 15% decrease in their the subject's one rep max. So this just kind of shows that that stretching can have a possible reduction in power and detrimental effects on training performance. Yeah. Not saying it's bad for you. It's going to decrease your performance ability in the gym and in the whatever competition it is you're doing.
I think stretching is highly dependent. If someone's going to the weights after stretching, I think that's not optimal. Mm-hmm. I try to tell clients, if someone's going to do long static stretching or whatever, think of, you know, they just, you know, they tired out muscle tissue, you know, when you're stretching and you just stretched it. Mm-hmm. What are you about to go do when you go lift weights? You're about to contract
it. Yeah, it's tough for it to want to revert back in the opposite direction.
Exactly. It's not going to want to perform as good as it had if it had not been stretched.
Now, like I said, there's three studies I looked at, and all of them did show an increase in range of motion and flexibility. So is that going to help maybe decrease your chance for injury? Possibly. But it is going to lead to a decrease in performance.
Yeah, so as far as static stretching, I think there's good science to show that post-exercise it's good.
Yeah, no, from the data I looked at, it did say that, you know, post-exercise stretching wasn't detrimental. You know, the next day, there was no effects on their ability to produce that one rep max again. So I personally, I should more often. I don't do all the time.
I think
post-workout. It's going to be much better for you than doing it prior. Now, if you're getting ready for an athletic event and you're an athlete, you know, I'm not going to say, like, don't static stretch because, again, your toes are probably going to make you anyways. And it is going to increase your range of motion and your flexibility.
I think it depends on the exercise they're going to do. If someone's going to go do, like, cross country, I think static stretching is fine. If someone's about to go do sprints or play football, basketball.
So a power event.
A power event or, honestly, just a sport that, you know, you're not doing long distance running, to be honest. And you know, I would say that if you're going to be doing power sports, dynamic stretching.
My recommendation is always dynamic stretching. It's all about getting the core temperature up and getting those muscles activated. Getting your body just moving and your juices flowing.
Yeah, you know? Your juices flowing. Yeah. You got the blood flow. You got a little bit of nutrients going. So, you'll hear people in the weight room talk about warm-up sets. And that's a form of dynamic stretching.
It is, yeah. And I perform those
all the time.
Especially with my big movement, squat, bench press, deadlift.
So, those warm-up sets, that's just to get a little bit of blood flowing, get a little bit of warmth in muscle tissue and joints. Mm-hmm. It's not necessarily fatiguing muscle, but it's just making sure that nutrients are getting where it needs to so you can actually do the exercise properly. I would do that way more than static stretching before exercise. You got anything else for
me? I think we covered it. There's a lot of new research coming out showing that the reduction in performance static stretching, and a lot of people are paying attention to it.
I think it used to be a huge thing.
Yeah, and I know a lot of strength and conditioning coaches and just coaches in general are leaning more towards dynamic warm-ups, and I like it. I like where we're going with it.
No, I do too. All right, I'm going to touch on fasted cardio.
Yep, go for it.
All right, fasted cardio. Man, how many bros go to the gym and do fasted cardio?
I was one of them.
It's ridiculous.
I was,
Fasted cardio, you know, science does show that you, in fact, do burn more fat during the cardio session.
Only during that exercise bout, right?
Exactly, only during the exercise.
However,
a 24-hour period is everything. Mm-hmm. So, you know, during that cardio session, you are going to burn more fat if you go do fasted cardio. However, research shows that your fat cells are actually more sensitive to hypertrophy after that fasted cardio session.
Yeah.
So nutrient uptake helps to actually grow fat cells after fasted cardio just because they've been deprived of nutrients for so long. Mm-hmm. So you might be burning a little bit more fat during your cardio sessions. However, it's going to be, you know, canceled out just in that post.
Because those cells are more hypersensitive afterwards.
Exactly.
Okay. All right.
And then you look at the whole 24-hour period. Things like hunger, overall calorie intake, the 24-hour period, you're going to be able to see that there is just a cancellation in body fat. And that fasted cardio has nearly no benefit when it comes to burning that extra body fat. That's my opinion.
So where did the idea of fasted cardio come from? That was the way we should do it.
So I don't know where it originated.
Well, what's the idea behind it?
The idea is I'm in a fasted state. I have no insulin in my blood, so therefore I'm not going to be supporting, you know, like glucose shuttling into cells. What is my body going to be primed to burn? Fat.
You can be in an oxidative state.
Exactly. Yeah. I'm going to be in an oxidative state. You know, I haven't had a meal in a long time, and the best time for fasted cardio, I put quotation marks on that, is in the morning, right out of bed. People will go do that, especially, you know, physique competitors or bodybuilders that are really trying to optimize body fat loss. They'll go do that in the morning because, you know, they've been fasting all night, burning fat through night. By the way, you burn fat when you sleep, fun fact.
You burn fat all day.
Yeah, actually. You burn fat.
Sitting here right now, our bodies are generally in oxidative state.
Yeah, and as soon as I consume a meal, I'm going to put on fat. Mm-hmm. So it's the goal is just net loss at the end of the day. And then if you continue that fat, or, you know, what competitors are looking to do is continue that fat burn from sleeping into their cardio session. However, it studies to show that it is not as beneficial as we want it to be.
So what's the recommendation?
I would say recommendation is just do it when it's convenient. You know, cardio in itself, I've looked at studies that show that separating cardio and your strength training sessions might be best just because of your overall energy for those sessions.
Yeah. However, I definitely saw the best effects doing that for my competition prep.
When you're separating it?
Yeah.
For me, I'm lazy. I just do it after I've weight trained.
A lot of times after I train, I don't have the energy to go for a full 45 minutes or hour. Sometimes it's easier to split those up if you're, you know, contest prep kind of thing. Like,
yeah, if you have the time to do it and you can split it up, that's fine. Mm-hmm. For me, when I'm at work, it's been really convenient. Like, I'll have, you know, like maybe 3 dead hours in a row.
Just to train and go straight into cardio,
which I'll do. And that's convenient for my schedule. So I preach convenience 100% when it comes to cardio sessions. Anything else that you would like to touch on as far as cardio?
No, I like it.
All right. I'll let you take the next one.
All right. How about the idea that morning workouts are the best time to...
Ooh, yeah. Start your day with exercise.
Yeah.
For me, I think this becomes very individualized. There are morning people and there are night people. So 100%.
I'm a morning person. I'm not a morning training person. It is really hard for me to wake up and go work out in the morning, like early in the morning. It's so hard for me to do.
It's, you know, I like that it gets it out of my day. Mm-hmm. I like that I get to wake up, go to the gym, and then I'm done.
Well, then you don't have anything else to look forward to during the day.
I mean, yeah. I mean, you're right. I don't get to look forward to the weights later in the day. Mm-hmm. But I just notice a huge increase in power output and overall push in the gym if it's like after 2 p.m.
Right. So my energy levels are always down in the morning when I'm training. Same. Why is that?
And you know the answer to this, but I will answer it for you. Yeah. It's basically just cause, you know, our hormonal profiles aren't going to be optimal.
Right.
You know, testosterone slightly increases during the day, mm-hmm. human growth hormone slightly increases during the day. Things like estrogen kind of slightly go down, and, you know, cortisol.
There's something called the cortisol curve. I don't know if you've heard of that.
Yep.
About 3 p.m. usually for most people on a regular day is when you see those cortisol levels really start to sharply decrease. It's variable depending on when you wake up, but generally the afternoon, you see that cortisol curve just drop way down, and your cortisol levels are significantly lower than they were in the mornings.
Yep.
For those of you who don't know, cortisol is the stress hormone.
And it's a necessary hormone.
You know, it is. It's important to have, but it's highest in the mornings and then also like when you're under stress.
Yep.
So it has some catabolic effects to it. It's gonna limit the quality of your training, the quality of your recovery.
Yep.
It's
a catabolic hormone, and it does break down cells. It breaks down fat cells and muscle cells.
Yeah.
So when people say that cortisol inhibits fat loss, I would like to, you know, actually show them science and studies that show that cortisol is actually one of the hormones that enhances fat loss. But in a disease state where they're stressed all the time, now they have chronic cortisol. A little bit of a tangent there, but just fun fact on cortisol.
Oh, and then we'll get back into why evening or later in the day training is probably going to be better. You've had meals, generally?
Yeah, you're going to have a lot more nutrients.
Your glycogen levels are going to be replenished.
You know for me, that if I train in the morning, I actually prefer to train fasted in the morning only because I hate going to the weight room and having a full meal on my stomach.
See, I personally kind of like that feeling because when I'm lifting, we're lifting big, especially like on a leg day, I love going in with a full stomach just so I can just feel like I've got more power, and especially if I've got a weight belt on.
Yeah,
I just kind of push against it more. I've got that full stomach to push against it.
You're so weird.
No, I'm serious. Like I just feel like I've got more. I perform better. I don't get like sick to my stomach when I work out on a full stomach. I know some people do. It's very personalized.
Yeah, every once in a while, I'll have something light, like cream of wheat digests really easy for me. It's a relatively easy digesting food, and it's not something that weighs heavy in me. So sometimes I'll have that in the morning, or you know, sometimes I'll do the bro thing and have like gummy bears before but rarely. Maybe rice cakes. Rice cakes is another.
Yeah, that's something light. You know, you could just get some carbs in you.
Yeah, but most of the time, if I'm training in the morning, I'm gonna have some branch chains.
Mm-hmm.
I'll have some of those with my pre-workout, and I find that my pre-workout just hits me way better if I'm fasted. That's just personal.
Yeah.
That's just me.
It's very individualized.
Do I prefer to work out in the afternoon? 100%.
Yeah. So I also looked at some data that showed that evening, like even later in the evening, workouts might be better as opposed to afternoon, and then as opposed to morning, of course. Because in your first few hours of sleep, that is when your growth hormone levels are highest.
Yeah.
So if you just got done training, you go home, have a meal, and go to bed, that's going to be when your body's be at its peak anabolic state,
mm-hmm.
Rebuilding,
and you're
resting, and then those growth hormone levels are increased. It's putting you in a much better place to rebuild that muscle tissue that you just broke down, as opposed to training in the morning and then going all day without much help from your hormones.
Yeah, because you know, especially when we're natural athletes and we're not taking any sort of performance enhancing drugs, mm-hmm. optimizing our own hormonal profiles becomes even more important.
Yeah, and it can be difficult sometimes, but
it's also depressing sometimes.
Yeah, no, that's okay. That's another story.
We will do a podcast on steroids, by the way.
Yeah, I. My dad, he's just listening to all these podcasts. So like, when are you going to address the elephant in the room? Like, what are you talking about? He's like, I'm going to start talking about anabolics and steroids. And I was like, I didn't realize that was the elephant in the room, but we'll discuss it. Sure, yeah.
I mean,
tangent there, but
I think I'm pretty tiny. So if people see me and think that I'm on steroids, I'll take the compliment and be like, I don't think you have a clue. Steroids, they will definitely be talked about. So yeah, if you have the chance to work out in the afternoon, I think that's probably best. However, in the long run,
if your only chance to work out is in the morning,
yeah, work out in the morning. It's not gonna kill you.
No, like you preached earlier, convenience.
Exactly. It's better to go get it in than not get it in.
Yep, I agree.
All right, I'm gonna touch on core reps.
Please do.
Waist trainers.
Yeah, core reps. Sweat. core sweat bands, whatever you want to call them, training belts. Yeah.
Gets me shredded. That's all I care about.
The things you wear around your waist, your stomach, while you work out or do cardio.
Or see people do like Saran wrap or something.
Yeah,
like
that's basically it's the same effect. Yeah, except you're just not paying $30 for it.
Exactly.
Belt.
I think it's probably way more uncomfortable. I've never done that. We should do that sometime.
Test it.
Just to see what happens. I feel like it would be okay. We're definitely not going to do that. So you know, core wraps. There is a little bit of science behind it. You know, you can go look at studies, and I say look at studies. I have found one study that actually looked at.
Yeah, I found very little data on this as well.
I have found one study that looked at using a core wrap to help subcutaneous fat loss in their midsection. Mm-hmm. And you know, at the end of the study, they saw that there was a overall fat loss in their stomach.
Oh, great! So it works, right?
But I mean, sure. If you dig into the study, you know, they actually conclude that a wrap helps to, you know, burn fat in the core. But if you go look at the actual data, they don't even test for whole body fat loss.
They just tested the midsection, right?
They just tested midsection body fat.
So they weren't able to say, like, oh, maybe it's just the training and it's doing this because the whole body's also losing fat?
They didn't even take into account any other variable. They, of course, took actually some pretty intense biomarkers for fat loss in the mm-hmm. midsection. And, you know, there was a pretty significant reduction in body fat. However, they didn't test for anything like, you know, like calipers for any other parts of the body or just overall weight loss or what kind of training program they were on. Or what kind of diet program?
They didn't have them all their subjects on the same training?
They did not. They had, I think, a specific amount of time to go do their exercise.
Just whatever exercises they wanted to
yes.
do?
Yes. With a core wrap.
So as you're seeing, there's a lot of holes in this study that Joel's describing. And this is the only one out there that we were able to find that had any data supporting core wraps at all.
Yeah, it was a 2013 study by Moreira et al. If y'all actually want to go look that up, have fun. They're going to tell you that a core wrap helps you lose body fat. I'm here to tell you that they didn't look at near enough biomarkers or enough variables in the study for that to actually be true. In my own opinion, you know, the researchers, they might have been paid by I didn't think about that. They might have been paid by a core wrap producer.
They very well could have, yeah.
To have that conclusion.
Yeah.
That happens a lot. So when it comes to a core wrap, you know, you are sweating a lot more in your core.
Yeah, the idea that is that it's going to increase your core body temperature and increase the amount you sweat, especially in the core area.
Yep.
But what is this? Back to the first topic we talked about.
Oh, body fat loss. Or reduction in spots.
Spot reduction.
Spot reduction. Yeah. Sorry. So yeah, this kind of relates back to spot reduction. So if someone's trying to lose weight in their core, obviously they're going to have to reduce overall body fat. So you sweat in your core with a core wrap. Yes, you will drop sweat.
You'll drop body weight.
You'll drop body weight.
But what's that body weight going to be from?
It's just going to be water.
It's water weight.
So what's going to happen the next time that you drink water?
It's going to replenish.
It's just going to go right back to your cells.
Oh yeah. So like I've seen people, you know, post videos of whatnot with them unwrapping their core belt after they do it, and they're all lean and shredded and all sweat, like glistening with sweat.
I know. I'm like, okay, I'll start myron a little bit.
Yeah, it looks great, and then guess what? You go replenish your water, and it immediately goes away because it was just water that you lost.
Exactly.
It was just an aesthetic thing, not actual body fat in that area. You know, it doesn't make sense. It didn't work like that.
Yeah, I bet you if you go look at the actual, so if I was to go back and look at the numbers some more in that 2013 study, what's one of the main drivers for cell hypertrophy when it comes to fat cells? Fluid. I bet you that those cells had very little fluid in them.
I would say so. It probably was.
Yeah, I didn't even think about that. I just kind of thought about that on the ball. Yeah. All right, so core wraps, I think the BS. If you like training with them for cardio, I'm not going to tell you to not do it.
I'll tell you not to do it. It's going to make you lose excess water. And why would you want to do that?
Hey, you get a good selfie after your workout, maybe.
Yes, yeah. I'm all about retaining your water as much as possible, unless you're on your last week of a contest prep, but that's a different story.
No, yeah, you know? We'll get into that sometime. Maybe like peak week for me, we should do a podcast.
On peak week?
Let's do a podcast on peak week.
On what that entails? Okay.
Yeah, I like that.
All right.
All right, what do you want to touch on next?
The last one I have is the idea that squats are bad.
Oh, my goodness.
Squats are bad.
But that's how I hurt my back.
Yeah, well, I hurt my knees. Or
I know for a fact my back, form wasn't great.
My back hurts. Well, guess what? It's because your form was crap, and you're probably doing too much weight.
Yeah.
Is
your back engaged in a squat? 100%.
Yes.
You have muscles on your spine.
Those erectors in your spine, that's what's holding you stable, that and your core. Those are getting a huge workout. And when those are under-trained, and then you go and do a heavy squat...
Oh, my goodness.
Guess what? You're going to blow something.
I know.
It could be a couple of things, but it's not going to be good. It's not going to go great.
Whenever I have clients do squats or deadlifts, and they say that their back hurts, I want to go, well, you have muscles back there that you have never trained before.
No, I would shut that down immediately. No more heavy deads or squats for a while until we train up your stabilizers.
Oh, I know. And it's funny because I won't do it real heavy. You know, obviously I build up to that. Like, for instance, I just had a client that just maxed out at 205. She just crossed the 200
mark. Yeah,
200
nice.
Mark. It was nice.
Good for her.
Did I have her training that heavy from the beginning? I think the heaviest I had her do was 6 reps. And she actually didn't complain about back pain. Most people that have complained about back pain, I'll have them do like 15 reps just to build some integrity in their spine.
Yeah.
And they still tell me that their back hurts. And it's just because they've never trained their erectors before.
Yeah.
Squats, you know. I love squats.
Mm-hmm.
I have nothing against squats.
No, they're actually so good for you. Those axial loaded lifts are great. There's studies that show that those axial loaded exercises are going to help possibly increase testosterone.
Especially as a natural, I think squats are even.
No, yeah, they're very important. There's a lot of people that go out there that's like, oh, like you shouldn't let your knee go over top of your feet. You should just keep them straight over top of your ankle, or else it's gonna be bad for your knees. Don't go below 90 degrees. That's gonna be bad for your ankle. Well, it's all dependent.
Yeah.
It's all very dependent. Are you doing too much weight?
Possible.
Well, if you're doing too much, then maybe, yeah, that could be a problem. But if you're within your limits, doing what you're supposed to, yeah, you can go down past 90 degrees. Your knees can come forward in front of your ankles. That's fine. That is okay. You're not going to hurt yourself as long as your form is okay and you're not lifting more than you're capable to do with proper form.
Yeah, and anatomy is a huge individualization for this. So it's like, you know, some people have long femurs, some people have, you know, short tibias and fibulas. It's you know, lower bodies are so different. And you know, some people have great dorsiflexion and plantar flexion when it comes to their ankles. Some people, you know, their hips don't tilt real great. There's a lot of different variables and different anatomy when it comes to a squat. And I think
what you're kind of getting to here is even proper squat form can vary between individuals.
Yeah.
Yeah.
No, I preach bar path.
Mm-hmm.
I preach bar path.
I like that.
I think it should be relatively vertical when it comes to bar path. Like, I don't think there should be too much pelvic tilt to where the bar is going forward or backwards when they're going into their squat.
Yeah.
However, if you go look at most people, their regular bar path is going to be okay for the most part. Maybe some minor tweaks every once in a while, like pressure on their heels or things like that. But I actually don't worry too much unless I see that their hips are just, they have no flexion in their hips. Then it becomes a big problem.
Yep. That comes down to a flexibility aspect of it too.
What about knee pain in squats?
Yeah, so... that's a big complaint with squats. Again, the squats can help you reduce knee pain if you're building up to it.
It actually can.
The problem is, again, overdoing it. So many people then get knee pain and then avoid squats. Avoid squats and leg extensions, things like that, cause pain in their knee.
Yeah.
When you should be doing these to strengthen up the muscles around it,
yep.
and it's going to help reduce that pain. So, like, I work in a physical therapy clinic, and, like, we're rehabbing people with serious knee reconstructions, you know? Guess what they're doing? Forms of squats.
Yeah.
You know, like, this is helping them get better.
A lot of them will have internal or external tension with bands and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we do a lot of band work to prevent, like, knee valgus and things like that. Yep. Even knee varus, the opposite direction.
I like it. Mm-hmm. So, I would actually beg to say that a leg extension is going to have way more pain on someone's knees.
Yeah, just because of the angle it's putting your leg at yeah. and the torque that's going across that knee joint.
If you think of torque and gravity... Mm-hmm. You know, on the tip of your ankle when you're doing a leg extension, yeah. it's going to be way more pressure on the anterior portion of your knee. I think that if we were to put a bunch of test subjects together and make our own study, and we were to look at knee pain, I bet you most of those people experiencing knee pain are doing a lot of leg extensions.
Yeah, no, I definitely see that just because there's a lot of data coming out recently that I've seen saying that knee extensions or leg extensions, whatever you're going to call them, aren't really great for that knee joint.
Yeah.
I mean, they are great for isolating that quad in a
workout.
They are
great, and I do them myself.
I do too.
But I do them very lightweight.
Yeah,
like,
no.
Like 15 reps.
I don't think you really should be going in like the 6 to 8 rep range on these with heavy weight.
I think it's stupid. Why
yeah,
would you do that?
That's putting us so much tension on your knees. But yeah, no, squats, at the end of the day, do your squats. They're great.
Yeah.
They have a lot of benefits. It's going to increase your lean muscle mass in your legs. It's going to increase your core strength, which is going to increase your ability to squat. They have high caloric requirements, so they're going to be making you burn a lot of calories if that's what you're looking for in a workout. They are, I would argue to say, the most axial loaded exercise.
Yep.
And then it's going to help increase your bone mineral density as well.
Yep.
To help prevent injuries in the future.
If someone has a problem with squats, I think leg press is a great alternative
that is
to
a good,
work
yeah.
up to a
that's
squat.
What, so like in the clinic that I work at, we do start them on a leg press generally, you know.
Yeah, if you think of fighting gravity, you don't have to fight as much gravity on your knee if you're doing a leg press.
And there's a lot less variables like with your core and form and things like that. So yeah, but they always do work up to the squat, so they don't get to skip that.
Yeah, no, you get to a squat. Squats are essential. Mm-hmm. Start them on leg press. For instance, I had a client come in, and she has Lyme disease. Mm-hmm. And, you know, she said that her knees were hurting that day, and she couldn't do a squat. I had her do leg press. You can find alterations, but the goal is always...
Doesn't that affect your bone mineral density?
What?
Lyme disease?
Yeah.
Also,
like, pressure in joints.
Okay.
Yeah. So it's like... It's been like osteoporosis and stuff like that. Like that. Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. Okay. All right. That wraps up, in my opinion. I would like to end with one topic.
What you got?
High reps to get cut or toned and low reps to gain size. What's your thought?
I think that's a load of bull.
So
personal.
You know, muscle tissue, we know that there are three mechanisms of muscle growth. There's metabolic stress, which is buildup of metabolites in muscle tissue. There's mechanical tension, which is overload of weight on the muscle. And then there's cell swelling, or the pump, or things like blood flow and nutrients to muscle cells. Those different rep ranges are going to have different effects on muscle tissue. You know, we have type 1 fibers, which are slow twitch, you know, higher rep range are going to be more activated. And then we got type 2 fibers, you know, under low reps and heavier weight, that those are going to be a little bit more activated. Mm-hmm. So when someone tries to tell me that high rep is going to get someone toned, like, you'll go look at, you know, Mr. Olympia competitors, mm-hmm. they still believe that higher reps is going to get them more shredded for stage.
Yeah. So higher reps are just going to train you for more endurance.
Exactly.
It's literally all it is.
Is there a benefit to it? 100%.
That's one of the first things I learned in my strength and conditioning certification. Like, that if you want to train for endurance, hit up your 15 to 20 rep range. That's just going to train those type 1 fibers, and you're going to be better at whatever exercise you're doing it for longer.
Yeah, you'll get good at that rep range.
Yeah.
However, when it comes to incorporating higher weight training, you're going to suck.
Yeah.
So, you know, Those three mechanisms of muscle growth, metabolic stress, mechanical tension, and cell swelling, you gotta optimize all of those if you really wanna optimize muscle tissue. Mm-hmm. So higher reps and low reps, they both have their benefit. You know, higher reps, you might burn a few more calories in a session, which has probably led some people to believe that that's what gets them shredded. And lower reps, you're not gonna burn as much things like glycogen and carbs. Mm-hmm. You're not going to burn as many calories. And when I mean as many calories, I'm thinking like a difference of maybe 60 to 100 calories.
Yeah, well, when you're hitting that lower rep range, that is going to be a lot more strength training.
Yep.
You know, that's why you see powerlifters coming in and do 3 reps of bench press, 3 reps of squat, and 2 reps on a deadlift and call it a day. But guess what? They lifted a ton of weight.
Yeah.
So their caloric expenditure was still high.
It wasn't horrible. Yeah. And you know, low reps is kind of broad, and high reps is kind of broad.
Yeah. So there in numerous certifications that I've done, they kind of like just split it up and said, oh, like 3 to 6 is for strength training, 6 to 8 to 12 is hypertrophy. And then 15 and above is endurance. I think it's a little bit more of a continuum than that.
I think so too.
There's a lot more variable than that. It's not as cut and dry. There is some truth to it, but it's definitely not that like black and white.
Oh, absolutely not. So if someone is trying to get cut or toned, what do they have to have? They have to have muscle tissue in order to be cut or toned. Mm-hmm. So am I going to be doing high rep training and low rep training with them? 100%. Yeah. If someone is trying to gain size, you know, what are they needing to do? Put on muscle tissue. Am I going to have them do high rep and low rep training? 100%.
Got to combine them.
You got to do both, especially if your goal is to improve body composition. Mm-hmm. So I think that busts that myth wide open, in my opinion. If you're trying to get cut or toned, you got to lose body fat.
Yeah.
If you're trying to gain size, you got to be in a caloric surplus, and you do have to lift heavy, but higher reps is going to be beneficial too.
Mix it up. Don't be afraid to do both.
Don't be afraid.
Yeah.
Don't become a zealot for, you know, one end of the spectrum.
I hate zealots.
Vegans. JK. Not vegans. You got to be, you're a vegan, no problem. Maybe keto, I'll judge you a little bit.
If you're a keto zealot, there's a difference.
Yeah, if you're a keto zealot, keto has its plot. You got anything else for him? We covered a lot. This one's definitely running upwards of 45 as of right now.
Oh, nice. So, a little longer than I expected.
No, that's okay. We went in some depth, though.
Mm-hmm. I like it.
We covered a lot. We were definitely just hitting some things that have come to our mind over the past few weeks. Again, if you guys have thoughts on different subjects, you know, we kind of just highlighted them. We didn't even go into like super in depth to some of them. We just cited studies here and there for different topics. If you guys generally have some interest in something we didn't touch on today, just let us know. You know, I got nothing else for them.
No, but like you said, questions you guys have, comments, suggestions, send them our way, Instagram or text us if you know us. Whatever it is, we'd love to cover it. We're still waiting on a couple more items to get in for a Q&A session.
Yep.
Send them our way. As always, we appreciate you guys listening. If you've hung with us this long, be looking for another installment next week or so.
Yeah, we're I think trying to become a Monday thing might be nice. You know, of course, maybe that's unrealistic, but trying to do once a week, we're going to try and get better at it. We've been a little bit more busy these past few weeks, so this last episode became a little bit harder to record. And to be honest, we got a little lazy, I think.
We're also working on some other stuff with Flatline, so
there's some things developing.
Be on the lookout for some stuff in the future. I'm excited about it.
I'm really excited.
Hoping to share it with you guys. I'm done if you are.
No, I think that was good. Thanks for listening, guys. This is your host, Joel Cummins.
And Garrett Augsburger.
Thanks for tuning in, guys. Bye. I just want a flat line. I just want a flat line. Maybe this is all my fault. But I just want a flat line. I just want a flat line. Maybe we going too far.